Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:22 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 26th, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought that I would kick off this week with this graphic of the cumulative interest rate hikes that the Federal Reserve has gone through over the course of the last 60 years. What I find particularly interesting is that there was a sequence of higher highs all the way through until the beginning of the 1980s, and then a sequence of lower highs all the way through until 2000. And since 2000, we've had two higher highs. Now, I think this is particularly interesting because it tells us in no uncertain terms that the amount of tightening that has gone on after the two big recessions we've had in the last 20 years has in fact been more than the tightening that we've seen previous to that during the secular bull market that persisted between 1980 and 2000. Of course, the difference is that the cuts in between those two big recessions have been much more aggressive. They've been in the order of approximately 500 basis points. So what we're presented with in terms of the overall makeup of the outlook for interest rates has been a declining trend over the course of that same 40-year period. If you simply look at the Fed funds rate, well, then there is a very consistent sequence of lower rally highs with the just very brief change at the beginning of 2000. And since then, we have gone down and tested the zero level. Well, it's increasingly likely we're at the top of the interest rate cycle. So why on earth am I talking about Fed tightening when it's looking increasingly likely that we are going to see considerable Fed loosening between now and the end of the next recession? Well, I think it's worth considering that there have been a considerable number of storied investors and highly influential hedge fund managers and Jeff Gundlach, Ray Dalio, and Howard Marks, to name a few, have all predicted that we are going to have an inflationary outcome, that the bond market, bull market, is going to burst, that there is going to be a very significant problem with regard to the USA's unfunded liabilities, to the massive quantity of debt that has been created over the course of the last 40 years. And I think it's really makes sense to be worried about those points because when we look at the quantity of debt that's outstanding, well, it's really quite troubling. But what the process of Fed tightening tells us is that if we're at the top of the interest rate cycle this time, then the next time the Fed starts to tighten, if the trend persists, then they're going to tighten more than they did on this occasion. And what that would suggest is that we have potentially got 500 basis points of a cut from here if they do persist in cutting interest rates, and particularly in view of the fact that they wish to forestall the threat of a recession. But subsequent to that, there is the likelihood, if we go back and think about it in those terms, that the next time they start raising interest rates, it will probably be more than 600 basis points. And it's probably then at that stage that we're going to have the inflationary outcome. That's when you could potentially also have a buyer strike in terms of bonds. Well, what that suggests is that there's a significant interval between where we are right now and the kind of scenario that is being painted by some of these bond investors. And when we now then look at the outlook for the treasury markets, well, I think this is a pretty easy chart to analyze because All we have to do is look at the consistency of the trend. We had this failed upside break at the end of last year, and since then the yield has contracted in a really rather rhythmic and consistent manner. The pace of the contraction picked up at the end of the first quarter. And so far, this consolidation that we've had in terms of the yield over the course of the last month has been somewhat smaller than the two previous ranges that we've had within this downtrend. Well, the minimum requirement, therefore, to suggest that we are back in a supply-dominated environment for treasuries would be a bigger rally in the yield. But more than that, it's going to have to break the sequence of lower rally highs. It's most particularly going to have to sustain a move above the trend mean. And the trend mean right now is almost 50 basis points above where the yield is trading. So we would have to see a meaningful move, and it would be very clear on the chart that something had changed. In the absence of that kind of move, we would really have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. The one thing that we know is that there has been a massive change, and I think it is completely underreported just how influential this change is, that the Federal Reserve until quite recently had spent the last few years being data dependent and were very clear about how data dependent they were, whereas today what they're trying to do is to anticipate economic weakness, and they are trying to avoid a recession by easing policy now. There's a debate going on in the markets about whether the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates by half a point or a quarter of a point at the end of this month. But that is rather to miss the point. The bigger point is that once they start cutting interest rates, they usually don't stop at one, and that it is more about really the timing of the interest rate cuts rather than a question of whether they're in fact going to occur. When we then think about the size of the Fed's balance sheet, we're presented with a really good example here. This is the most that the Federal Reserve has reduced the size of its balance sheet ever. And over the course of the last 18 months, it has taken approximately $700 billion out of circulation. Well, that has put upward pressure on the dollar, but most particularly, it has removed liquidity from the system. So we've had a growth scare in the USA, but certainly nothing in the way of negative growth, merely a growth slowdown. Of course, the tightening has been occurring at the same time that we've had a rather large fiscal stimulus. What we've also started to see is the very real prospect that the USA is going to adopt a more formal arrangement to give voice to modern monetary theory rather than the informal arrangement that has persisted for decades. The US presidential cycle is such that there is this almost hand-in-hand unspoken agreement that the central bank will try and assist the incumbent because of the actions that politicians engage in. They try to prime the pump ahead of the election. They try to give some money away to make them look a bit better. They clear the audience stables basically immediately after the election so that they take the hit in terms of public opinion early in the administration, so that people will have forgotten about it by the time the next big election comes along. And what that suggests is that you generally get a growth scare in the first half of the third year of the US presidential cycle, and then you get some easing to make up for that in the latter half of the year, carrying through into the fourth year of the cycle. And what we're getting right now is this is going almost exactly to form, or it is following the progression of this cycle almost to the letter. Now, we are definitely going to have additional monetary and fiscal easing. The cross-party agreement that was signed this week in the USA to engage in a 1.7 additional fiscal $1.7 trillion additional spending agreement, well, that is almost as large a fiscal support that we had with the tax cuts. And that's rather important, because the US economy, despite the fact that the global economy has been slowing down, is really all about the domestic consumer. And the domestic consumer is still in pretty good form. So when we think about the outlook for global growth, then it's when we think then also about how the Fed is acting. They are attempting rather to stimulate demand and to stimulate growth overseas in order to insulate the US economy from any trouble that might occur. And that's a good part of the reason why they are going to start cutting interest rates. Of course, that would also put downward pressure on the dollar. And the US dollar has been rather strong over the course of the last few years. Now, when we look at the chart over the long term, we can see that it is right in the region of the peak from back in the early 2000s. And we're just starting to see some moderation coming through. This is taking the 1997 area as the base at 100. Well, when we then think about what would happen if the USA were to cut interest rates, engage in fiscal stimulus, and potentially even renew its quantitative easing program, well, it would put downward pressure on the dollar. Well, of course, if the dollar goes down, then everything else goes up. And the last thing that some of those weaker economies internationally want is a stronger currency. So the Federal Reserve might be cutting interest rates for its own reasons, but it leaves other countries with little alternative but to follow suit. So the ECB is talking about moving into negative interest rates. And it's quite likely, and certainly based upon what we had, or the statement we had from Mario Draghi yesterday, it's looking quite likely that September is going to be the time where the downtrend in the quantity of accommodation that's being afforded to the global economy is going to break its downtrend and start trending back up again. The Federal Reserve is also quite adamant that they want to exit the mortgage market. But just to exit the mortgage market and begin to roll off their holdings, either through just allowing bonds to mature, and also because of the difference in mortgage bonds is that you get the prepayments coming through, and that can change the maturity of the bonds you hold. That suggests that there is going to be a runoff in terms of the mortgage bonds. There's going to have to be that would have to be compensated for with additional purchases of treasuries. And therefore, the Federal Reserve, one way or the other, by the time we get around to September, is going to be buying U.S. treasuries. Quite whether that is going to be on a neutral basis or on a net positive basis has yet to be determined, but it is going to act as a support for the bond market. And if that is the case, then we are at the cusp here of additional monetary accommodation, fiscal accommodation, and potentially even regulatory accommodation. Well, of course, there is the clear potential that the ECB is going to start its quantitative easing program again in September. And it really does need to do that. Well, when we start to think about the outlook for the banking sector in Europe, it's badly in need of some assistance, with the prospect of negative interest rates, having to pay depositors to put their money in. That doesn't really sound like such a great idea. and the European banking index might be stable around the lower side of this 8-year range, but it needs to push higher in a dynamic manner in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The holiday season is kicking off in Europe, and there are a large number of people that are just not going to be at their desks for at least the next 6 weeks. And that suggests that it is probably going to be September before the ECB meets and makes a big decision. But also, it would be, I think, it is the time to pay attention to some of these oversold markets, because when the market is illiquid, it doesn't take an awful lot of money to move it. And it is the kinds of dynamic moves we get in about the 6 weeks between the middle of July and the beginning of September that can set the tone for the outlook and the perception of what's possible when people return to their desks in September. If that is additionally greeted with an additional quantitative easing program from the EU, well, then that is likely to be beneficial for asset prices. I think what's most important right now is the commonality that we're seeing in the bond markets. It's not simply that we have a downtrend in US Treasuries. If we think about the downtrend that's evident in German Bunds, where the 10-year is trading at negative 37 basis points, it was a little bit more volatile yesterday, but it was in additional negative territory again in here today. Then, if we think about everywhere else, it just, I mean, I think there is a lot of concentration and commentary about what's going on in the USA and in the Eurozone, but the downtrend that we have in the Australian 10-year yield has been really quite profound. The range that persisted between 2015 and 2018 has been very conclusively broken. And I think when we think about this over the long term, there is the real potential that Australia is going to be the next major developed market to move into, or at least to go down and test the zero bound, and particularly on some of the shorter dated parts of the curve, and potentially even go negative. The fact of the matter is that the RBA is cutting interest rates. The government in Australia is running a fiscal deficit, and then there are additional measures being implemented to try and support the housing market. So again, here is another example of a country where there is a clear intention to try and forestall the threat of a recession. And I do think that there is the likelihood here that Wall Street is going to continue to be the outperformer, because it is arguable whether the domestic US economy really needs all of this additional stimulus. There is no question that the European economy definitely needs it, and they are totally reliant on the ECB to provide additional activity, because there is just no appetite to really focus on the fiscal austerity regime that has been underway for over a decade. Of course, there are very clear political reasons for that. The Europeans are intent on trying to harmonize debt-to-GDP ratios, and it isn't before that happens, or it won't be until that happens before they can really start to think about implementing cross-border fiscal supports for various countries. That's because they're terrified of moral hazard. Then there is the additional question of Germany not wanting to run any kind of deficits at all, but it is looking increasingly likely that the German economy is moving towards the potential for a recession. Now, when we look at, for example, the Ifo index, there is a clear downward trend, and This is the biggest deterioration since at least 2010, but it's coming down a lot faster. So there's a real, well, I guess Germany only just about squeezed past avoiding a recession at the end of last year, unless the ECB starts to get really quick with cutting interest rates and then further boosting its quantitative easing program, well, then Germany could in fact be moving into a recession. Well, it's at that point that the question of fiscal stimulus will start to become a much more relevant consideration. But if we start to string it all together, monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. The big question that we had at the end of last year was, where is the additional stimulus going to come from to support markets and the global economy? Well, over the first half of this year, we've had the answer. The USA is engaging in additional monetary and fiscal stimulus. The ECB is looking at going into negative interest rates. And that's an incredibly profound change. The total of bonds with a negative yield is almost at $14 trillion. Now, that is undeniably a bubble. One of the most the clearest characteristics of bubbly activity in any major secular bull market has been the clear evidence of a contradiction. So in the 1990s, it was earnings don't matter. When it was Japan's big bull market in the 1980s, it was that the Imperial Palace in Tokyo is worth more than the entire state of California. When we think about the massive moves that we had in commodities and fertilizer stocks in 2008 and 2009, well, it was because the world is going to run out of food. Now we're at a point, there's the additional one about credit default swaps. It was that everybody can hedge their default probability. Well, of course, we know that's not true. Somebody has to bear the default risk. When it was ahead of the 1987 crash, it was everybody could hedge their equity exposure. Well, of course, that's not entirely the case. Now we have this clear conclusion in the markets that that deficits don't matter. Well, of course, we know deficits do matter, but the bond market is behaving as if they don't. And that is a very clear contradiction. But it's not going to become a clear and present danger until we get an inflationary bias returning. It's at that point that the massive accumulation of debts that has been going on for decades is going to become problematic. But in between now and then, in between when we do eventually start to get inflationary pressures rising and the period now where central banks have transitioned from being data dependent to anticipating data, well, in between those two things is the potential for a bubble to form. It is exactly when, the other way of thinking about it is that bubbles form when central banks make mistakes. And the willingness of central banks to anticipate data rather than rely on data is an example of a mistake that is being made. They are willing to tolerate the risk of massive asset price inflation rather than try and tackle the underlying problems of inequality, the absence of equality in terms of opportunity, or the massive unfunded liabilities. So what we're basically getting right now is monetary policy and economic policy on a wing and a prayer. They're hoping that by stimulating growth that there is the potential that something is going to come along to miraculously completely change the debt metrics, with massive outsized growth. And there is the potential for that, but obviously the problem with relying on that conclusion is that the quantity of debt is continuing to rise. It's in fact, they are behaving as if there is an absolute surety that a new source of growth is going to appear to moderate the debt to GDP ratios that continue to advance. In the meantime, if we are at the beginning of a bubble phase, I think it is worth starting to think about the consistency of the long-term trend. And when we think about the long-term trend, well, what we have on the S&P 500 are these incredibly lengthy periods where it just does nothing at all. And when we think about it in those terms, it is within these long ranges that we have the greatest potential for very meaningful pullbacks in terms of stock market activity. It's on these occasions where you get these secular periods of stagnation that you can have really profound pullbacks. But when we look at the trending phases in these major secular bull markets, it's quite unusual that they spend very much time below the 1,000-day moving average. And that was particularly the case in the period between approximately at 1950 and all the way through until approximately 1970. And then we started to see support getting found in the region, and I definitely stress in the region of the 200-day moving average, excuse me, of the 200-week or 1,000-day moving average on the really big pullbacks between approximately 1982 and all the way through until 2001. We started to see it again in 2012, and we just saw another example of this phenomenon over the course of the last few months, where the low at the beginning of this year was right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. That doesn't mean that the 200-day moving average can be ignored. In fact, it is during the periods where we get really impressive advances that the 200-day moving average becomes particularly useful, because it often acts as a touchstone for activity, and most particularly when we start to find support and at progressively higher levels following the nadir of the big medium-term corrections. Well, then that's when the 200-day moving average starts to become more relevant. Well, then I guess there is an easy way to think about this. The 1,000-day moving average is the secular trend mean, and the 200-day moving average is the medium-term trend mean. In order to really conclude that the secular bull market is over, we would need to see a move below the 1,000-day moving average. And we're a long way from that. There is, in fact, the potential here that the market is going to begin to accelerate away from both the 200-day and the 1,000-day moving averages, because explosions, or excuse me, ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And when we think about the consistency of the trend, we also know that there have been three 18-month consolidations within this advance. And it's looking increasingly likely that the most recent of those has just ended. And on the previous two occasions, when the medium-term range was completed with a reversion back to the 1,000-day moving average, then we got an impressive rally. And this rally is now being led higher by the kinds of companies that have got really strong cash flows. what we're definitely, though, starting to see is differentiation. The very impressive rally that we had in 2017 was basically an everything rally. Everything went up at the same time. And when it started to pull back in 2018, everything came back at the same time. But what we are now seeing is some differentiation, that investors are beginning to look at the clear winners versus the highly leveraged companies that may not be able to survive beyond, or at least may not survive if they do not have ample access to additional liquidity. And what we've definitely seen over the last year and a half is patience waning. That's particularly true of companies like Tesla. Tesla does have a product in the market, but it posted a large downside weekly Q reversal this week from the region of the trend mean and the lower side of the overhead trading range. It's going to have to find support above 200 if this isn't a completed top formation. So that's really a very clear example. Netflix has been subject to acute volatility over the course of the last year, and it is also the subject of a lot more competition. When we think about the fact that it is trading on an estimated PE of 102, and that its price to book value is 24, or that its price to sales ratio is 8. That means that if they stopped investing, they didn't produce even one more new show for the next 8 years, that it would take all of their sales to justify their price. And I really think that that is a great example of what is effectively a very high yield company. These kinds of companies have got bonds, and the bonds are rated BB. The yield on Netflix debt is 2.4%. And that, to me at least, looks like one of the most profound mispricings of debt imaginable, that it is still trading at a premium to par. And I find this an incredibly interesting phenomenon. These are the kinds of companies where we are already starting to see an unfavorable attitude starting to appear. Align Technologies, those Invisalign braces, which they look more cosmetically appropriate, but they don't work in terms of realigning teeth, is now starting to come down and come down heavy. Well, when we think about the fact that they don't have bonds, so that means that all of their money is locked up in the equity. Or the other way of thinking about it is that all of investors' money is highly dependent on the fact that they've got a price to book ratio of 11.5 and a price to sales ratio of 7. These are the kinds of companies that are no longer getting the kind of bullish attention from investors that they were enjoying for most of this bull market to date. This is a good example that liquidity conditions have tightened and that underwriting standards have tightened, that private equity investors are becoming much more picky about what they're willing to put their money into. And there is a clear favoritism by investors to simply look at strong balance sheets. Well, the kind of performance that we've seen in the last few weeks from companies like McDonald's and Starbucks has been really quite outstanding. And anyone who looks at the consistency of this trend knows that every time McDonald's gets this overextended relative to the trend mean, it pulls back. So we would have to consider that there is an acute risk of a reversion to the mean at this stage for these some of these high-flying companies. But what I find particularly interesting is you look at the trend and the shape of the trend for McDonald's, or the shape of the incredible breakout that we've seen on Starbucks. And I think it is also worth highlighting that in an accelerating trend, you often get the biggest dynamic at the top. So there has been an incredible amount of good news priced into Starbucks. It's right at $100. This is a natural area where people should be asking, what's next? And there is definitely room in which to consolidate, considering that it could pull back by 25% and still only be approaching the region of the trend mean. It's, I think, really quite clear that when we start to look at the shape of the moves in these consumer-oriented companies, that there is a clear demand dominance for very strong cash flows. And that thread of strong cash flows is moving straight through to the technology sector. So Microsoft is still pushing on to new high ground, and the pace of the advance is most definitely picking up. So we are now looking at a very clear potential for bubbly activity to start to emerge in the subscription business model. And the fact that what we've seen over the last decade is a massive transition in terms of the business models of technology companies, so that they have streamlined their cash flows. They have turned highly cyclical businesses into the kinds of reliable cash flow businesses that we associate with consumer staples and consumer discretionary. And that continued demand for these kinds of shares, whether they are in the fast retail or, I guess, fast food, whether it is in consumer electronics or in terms of software, whether it's in terms of payments like Visa or credit scoring like Experian, then what we're presented with is this exactly the same shape of advance. I think this is by far the most important trend that we're seeing out there right now. It is the continued outperformance of a very core group of autonomies that are leveraged to continued consumer demand growth. The industrial companies have languished because they're much more levered to China. They're much more dependent on continued global growth, but they have a very clear focus on demand and from the Chinese economy, and China's economy is slowing down. They're running a massive fiscal stimulus, and when some of their regional banks went bust earlier in the year, then they flooded the market with a significant amount of liquidity. But the problem for investors investing in China today is the clear political motivation of the administration rather than a commitment to improving governance or maintaining minority shareholder interests or indeed property rights or a free press. China has none of those things and instead has an increasingly onerous administration, where the monitoring of the domestic populace is taking on unprecedented scale, and there is a much more defensive attitude in terms of the management of the economy, and that is reflective of the slowing growth, the kind of self-confidence and hubris that arises from growth that has persisted for decades without interruption. Well, what we do know is that China is heavily dependent on global growth. They are heavily dependent on trying to stoke domestic demand. They have got a property bubble. And the only thing that is continuing to see that Chinese bubble expand is access to liquidity. Well, China is eventually going to have to step on the fiscal and monetary stimulus accelerators. What the A-share market appears to be suggesting is that a consolidation is currently underway. I strongly regard China as a trader's market rather than an investor's market. It is simply not the kind of place you can put your money in and walk away for 10 years, because there is absolutely no guarantee that it is still going to be there when you get back. What happens, however, in terms of the Chinese economy and its ability to continue to grow or at least remain stable, is going to have a substantial impact on the outlook for global growth. And I think that is part of the reason why we're getting a concerted effort by central banks all over the world, everywhere from the USA to Europe to Australia to Japan to China to Mexico, Brazil, South Africa, that they all of the largest economies in the world, whether they are is South Korea or Taiwan, are looking at cutting interest rates and trying to stimulate their economies. That suggests that we are at the trough in global growth. There is a lead in terms of that monetary accommodation, and when it starts to show up in economic activity of about 6 months, which suggests that by the end of the year we should have already seen the turn in the global economy. Of course, that is assuming that it all happens quick enough to forestall a serious contraction in China. China is the weak link in terms of global growth. The fact that Germany continues to underperform on an economic front is a direct response to that weakening demand growth profile in China. That also, I think, raises the issue of the rise of the global consumer is a very significant factor in terms of the growth of the consumer-led market in terms of the autonomies. But the rise of the Western consumer as a driver of populism and reshoring, anti-globalization, or additional spending is an additional point. And most particularly, it is this protectionism and this trend towards anti-adventurism that is likely to create an isolationist perspective over the medium term. And that's not good for China either. So there is I think, a very clear transition coming in terms of the global economy. And I do think that China is where the big risks lie. Then we think about the oil price. Well, one of the things that would really have an or raise a headwind to the potential for a bubble to form would be a significant rally in oil prices. But the simple fact of the matter is that despite the significant uptick in geopolitical tensions over the course of the last month, oil prices haven't moved at all. The USA has turned from being the biggest importer to being one of the biggest exporters of oil, and that represents a profound geopolitical game changer. In fact, the USA doesn't really have a vested interest in having ultra-low energy prices any longer. They certainly don't want to have high energy prices because of what it would do to the domestic economy, but they are garnering a significant quantity of additional revenue from exporting oil that was simply impossible before. And that's incredible geopolitical change because it gives the USA greater potential to throw its weight around internationally, and that is exactly what we're seeing. The willingness to put sanctions on Iran and Venezuela, that was impossible before the advent of unconventional oil and gas, for the simple reason that those countries could cut off supply, and that would put a strangle on the US economy. Well, the fact that the USA is now a major exporter completely changes the rationale. And this is not something that is going to go away. In fact, it's likely to intensify because the USA is awash in oil. And that is a change that I think the global economy is simply going to have to get used to. It also suggests that we are going to see additional new sources of demand emerging in the energy sector. Natural gas prices are really low. And when we think about the long-term trend, natural gas is one of the few commodities that is really very close to the kinds of prices that were prevailing ahead of the commodity bull market. So this is a step change in the marginal cost of production. Generally speaking, with energy, we anticipate that that rise in the marginal cost of production is in fact what characterizes secular bull markets. You get a massive investment in terms of new supply. That new supply comes in at a slightly higher level, and you just get a step up in the price structure. That's not happened in natural gas. The sources of natural gas that are now on tap are so much more prolific than previously that we could see prices going down below $2 and staying there. That is likely to create demand for natural gas from additional sources. Whether that is going to be in terms of additional heating and cooling, particularly for Europe, or whether it is going to represent the dawn of a hydrogen fuel cell market through hydrogen being produced en masse from reforming of natural gas. But the lower prices go, the greater the incentive will be for new markets to emerge. That's simple economics 101. It virtually ensures that there is going to be a hydrogen fuel cell future. I also pay. I guess I'm a bit of a wonk, and I just read everything I can find on fusion technology. I found it particularly interesting that Lockheed Martin is looking at completing their T5 prototype for modular fusion reactors by the end of this year. And that suggests that they will look for full power and size two more prototypes after that. This week, the ITER project in the south of France took delivery of some of its major components, and they anticipate first plasma in about 2025. And they'll be ramping up to full tritium breeding capacity a decade after that. Well, that's the deadline that private companies have to beat. Creating a modular design for fusion reactors is almost it's it hasn't even become commercially viable for fission reactors because of the proliferation risks. There is the scope here that within the next 10 or 15 years we are going to have a working fusion reactor. And that could kill the energy industry generally, because it would greatly enhance the availability of hydrogen. It would also greatly enhance the utility sector. Well, when we're thinking about what it is that is going to be a major game changer, this would absolutely have to be something that we just have to pay attention to, because it would represent a profound change in terms of the global economy. The fact that Google was able to surge in a really quite impressive way in here today on the back of strong earnings is also worth mentioning here. Google absolutely needs to hold the $1,000 level, and so far it has done that in a pretty admirable fashion, particularly following today's break or substantial run on the upside. But Google is also one of the leaders in terms of developing driverless technology, and that represents an additional game changer in the potential for transportation and efficiency, and the quantity of time that workers spend commuting or sitting in their cars, which could instead be used for either leisure or productive activity. Well, that represents a massive step forward in terms of the efficiency of the individual worker. And that is something we do need to pay attention to. It is also something, of course, that lots of other companies are engaged in. And Tesla has been promising it for the last few years. Well, there is, of course, a wide gap in terms of where people anticipate the end date or the delivery of this kinds of technology, and it's probably a couple of years away, at least, if not 5 years away or potentially 10 years away. But again, it is the delivery of these kinds of technologies that we have to think about. How is it that markets price in these potentials? Well, generally speaking, they price in the potential before the reality. You do get buy the rumor, sell the news. The more progressive are the closer we get to these deliveries of these kinds of technological innovations, the greater the likelihood is that it will already have been fully priced in terms of the performance of the relevant shares. And I think that's one of the foundations for the secular bull market hypothesis. One thing that I thought was particularly interesting is that when we think about the outlook for the Dow gold ratio, well, when when we think about the long term, and I'm going to have to find this chart. I'm sorry for the longer time pulling this up. The Dow gold ratio has been one of the most reliable cyclical indices for decades. What I find particularly interesting is that there is approximately 35 years between the peaks. Therefore, the next peak in terms of this ratio could potentially be sometime in around 2035, and it's quite likely to be above the peak that we saw in 2000, if previous history is any guide. The fact that the 2035 area is where the Dow gold ratio should potentially peak, and that is also potentially when we may get full fusion commercially available, then that's also the coincidence of those two dates I find to be particularly interesting. What it suggests is that over the next half of this secular bull market, what we are going to be busy doing is pricing in the potential for technological innovation to deliver life-changing productivity growth in terms of the global economy, whether that is autonomous vehicles or fusion energy, or whether it is deep learning and artificial intelligence, whether it is the advent of personalized medicine, or the further exploration of the microbiome, or the increasing drive towards exploring the medicinal qualities of cannabis and magic mushrooms. All of these have the potential to represent really big changes in terms of how the human condition is managed on a day-to-day basis. And that suggests that there is ample scope for additional upside, that when we think about the big moves we've had in the market, then we do get these pauses occasionally in secular bull markets. There is no secular bull market that doesn't have the occasional recession. But when we think about where it is that we're likely to get the inflationary bias, it could be a few years from now. But what we are starting to see is that gold is already pricing in the competitive currency devaluation that is already underway in the global economy. This race to inflate debt totals, to provide fiscal stimulus, and to compete internationally for the weakest currency is having a clear effect on the outlook for gold. And gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies. So it has broken out to new all-time highs in an increasingly large number of currencies that have been weak over the course of the last few years, particularly those that are influenced by the commodity cycle. But the most important point is that there is no currency that I've found, at least, where gold is in fact making a new low. It has broken out in just about every currency. And what that tells us is that gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies, because gold is a monetary metal. And as a monetary metal, it can be valued like a currency, and all currencies are valued on a relative value basis. No currency is going up unless the currency you're converting it into is going down. And gold is appreciating in every currency because it is outside the financial system, because it cannot simply be lent or printed into existence. And that is a very, I think, alluring characteristic against a background where nominal prices for stocks are rising, but the purchasing power of fiat currencies is declining. So stock markets are a hedge against the declining value of the money in your pocket, and so is gold. And that is, I think, one of the biggest changes that we've had. The fact that gold is increasingly doing better is starting to drag up the gold miners. There are a considerable number of gold miners that have got all-in production costs in the region of $850 to $900. Some have even lower costs than that, and that gives them leverage to the gold price at this stage in the cycle. The junior miners, those that have got production, are even more heavily leveraged to the gold price. It's when gold miners start to get over-enthused and start borrowing a pile of money and going out and building ambitious greenfield projects that they trash their balance sheets and they start to underperform relative to the metal. We're nowhere near that yet. We're in fact only at a period where the bigger miners are trying to take over one another so that they can capture guaranteed supply. They're not yet willing to invest in additional greenfield projects. Well, that suggests that we're still in the period where gold miners have got leverage to the gold price. And I think one of the most attractive characteristics about gold at this stage in the cycle is it's cheap. And the gold miners in particular are at fractions of where they were back in 2010. So they have got significant potential to outperform as we move progressively into this debt-fueled binge in terms of stimulus. When we do eventually get the next recession, then there is the potential that we are going to get a buyer's hiatus in terms of bonds that will necessitate the cumulative Fed tightening to exceed 600 basis points. And that's when yields would likely to break their medium-term downtrend. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.